lot of ways the public has kind of gone to sleep on the issue of nuclear weapons. I think that's changed to some extent more recently because we did see, you know, the rising tensions with North Korea, and the Trump administration, you know, has these many missteps and more dangerous actions. There is not a lot of awareness of this issue for the average person. And actually for myself, for my generation, I'm 25, you know, when I talk to my friends, this is not an issue that they are concerned about. It's not on their top 10, you know, list of things that they're thinking about.
That's Lily Adams, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamian. This edition of AR features Lily Adams and Bruce Amundsen on preventing nuclear apocalypse. You may know Apocalypse as a Marvel Comics supervillain. It is a word of Greek origin, meaning the catastrophic final destruction of the world. The use of nuclear weapons would be apocalyptic. It is difficult to imagine extinction. Understandably, most people would rather not think about it. The term nuclear war is misleading and false. It suggests that one side would come out on top, that there would be a winner and a loser. No way. We'd all be losers. Nevertheless, countries, including the United States, go on building new nuclear weapons that are called smarter and packing more of a wallop. It's a worldview Dr. Strangelove would have appreciated. In the interests of sanity and self-preservation, the nuclear weapons states must move toward eliminating these weapons of mass destruction that, if used accidentally or deliberately, will destroy our precious planet. Our guests today are Lily Adams and Bruce Amundsen. Lily Adams is the coordinator of Washington Physicians for Social Responsibility's Nuclear Arms Abolition Campaign. She has worked as a community organizer with various civil society groups. Bruce Amundsen is a former president of and longtime member of Washington Physicians for Social Responsibility. He has taught at the University of Washington Medical School. I talked with them in Seattle.
Welcome to the program, Lily Adams.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
And welcome to you too, Bruce Amundsen.
Thank you.
Well, it's been more than 7 decades since the first use of nuclear weapons by the United States on Japanese cities, Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Since those events of 1945, what has changed in terms of proliferation of nuclear weapons?
Since 1945, we obviously saw the massive buildup during the Cold War of nuclear weapons and a huge and incredibly expensive nuclear arms race, especially between the U.S. and Russia. But then, of course, since then, many other countries have also gotten nuclear weapons. So now, today, 9 countries have nuclear weapons, and that's the U.S., Russia, China, the U.K., France, India, Pakistan, Israel, and now North Korea. What really troubles us looking at this today is we had that big buildup of nuclear weapons, but then we saw a real dramatic decrease after the end of the Cold War, in which, you know, we decided we have to have an end to these nuclear weapons. We have to work towards disarmament and eventually the elimination of nuclear weapons. But then we kind of went to sleep. And since the end of the Cold War, I think the issue kind of dropped off our radars politically and with the public. And so we're concerned today that what we see in our government is still kind of a persistence of Cold War era policies around nuclear weapons and a really strong commitment still to having them despite a very different, you know, global and political situation today. And so, you know, I think that is something that we have really worked to challenge on this issue.
And many people don't realize that at the peak, there were like 70,000 nuclear weapons in the world. And then those have decreased through arms control negotiations down to about 14,000. Mm-hmm. So we've shown that something useful can happen when reasonable people get together and negotiate.
Yeah, we today, the world has, as we said, about 14,000 nuclear weapons. 93% of those, though, are held by the U.S. and Russia. The U.S. on its own has roughly 6,500, a little under, nuclear warheads. Bruce and I are in Washington State, and roughly 1,200 of those are right here in our home state.
Now, Bruce, there's a culture of secrecy that persists around the topic of nuclear weapons, a kind of legacy of the Cold War that we really haven't shed. Can you talk about that?
Nuclear weapons policies have been absolutely deep-sixed from the standpoint of national security since the beginning. While we know basic numbers, the extent to which policies have remained secret, the extent to which targeting has been secret, the extent to which certain policies have existed that we have never acknowledged, like the willingness to use nuclear weapons first, it's been unlike any other part of our foreign policy history. Nuclear weapons have been governed by a really disastrous culture of secrecy up until today.
And why is that?
Well, under the guise of national security, what do we do whenever we think there's something that is threatening to us? The governments tend to pull the covers of secrecy over it. And because the use of these weapons has such massive implications, the less the public knows, the less they have to justify them.
And in terms of the destructive capacity of these weapons, if they are ever used, Noam Chomsky has said it's a miracle with all the close calls that we've had that there hasn't been a general catastrophe involving these weapons of mass destruction.
Much of the time, the public dialogue and the political dialogue goes on as if these weapons were just an extension of conventional weapons, and they're not. I think it's useful to sort of walk through what happens with a nuclear blast. I mean, most people have seen pictures of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, but if we consider the impact of an 800-kiloton weapon, which is about 40 times the size of the weapon on Hiroshima, which is a pretty typical size of many of today's weapons, exploded over a U.S. city. Here's what happens. First, the blast generates forces of 100 pounds per square inch, so all buildings within a diameter of a mile are flattened, and everything that's loose becomes projectiles, flying debris through the air, but all houses within a diameter of 7 to 8 miles are frame houses are destroyed. Then comes a firestorm with surface temperatures of 16,000 degrees, or 2.5 times the surface of the sun, exposing everybody within 15 miles of third-degree burns, and anybody exposed with third-degree burns would die if they survived the firestorm. About 2 minutes after detonation, the upward sweep of vertical afterwinds from the heat brings counterwinds of 250 to 300 miles an hour, sweeping vertically, carrying massive amounts of soot and debris and carbon in the air. And then the third effect is from the radiation, with huge amounts of radiation, especially gamma rays, exposing everybody in that typical zone of 150 square miles or so to lethal doses of radiation. Acute radiation sickness, people typically die within days or weeks in addition to chronic exposure. There is no response to such an explosion in an urban area.
We saw in the aftermath of Hiroshima, which was a much smaller bomb that was used there, anywhere between 80 and 90% of doctors and nurses had died in the blast, and also between 80 and 90% of medical institutions were destroyed. So, you know, we're talking about these catastrophic consequences and absolutely no infrastructure or help available to deal with them. It is, you know, absolutely tragedy that, you know, I think we cannot even imagine today.
What does the term nuclear winter mean?
There's been really good modeling now, and as I suggested, in the wake of a blast like this, there's millions of tons of soot and carbon that are injected high into the atmosphere. So the modeling was done with a limit, quote, so-called limited nuclear exchange. For example, India and Pakistan, if they used as few as 100 nuclear weapons in Asia with the smoke and the fires, the carbon in the atmosphere is projected to drop atmospheric temperatures across the entire northern hemisphere, which would have an impact on food production. Serious reductions of rice and winter wheat in China, of corn and wheat in the U.S., dropping to levels that would impact food production and project at least 2 billion people at risk of starvation. And this would last, even with 100 weapons, as projected, for 10 years. And if there were a major nuclear war with the kind of weapons that are in the arsenals, it's projected it would drop temperatures to nothing seen since the Ice Age, which would be incompatible with life on the planet. It's mutually assured suicide is what the reality would be.
Yeah, it's very important as we think about policy today, you know, to remember what many political leaders and, you know, leaders in the military have absolutely understood, which is there are no winners in a nuclear war. There's no such thing as a limited nuclear war, even though that phrase still gets thrown around today as well. But yeah, we know that there are no survivors. This is not something to contemplate.
Now, in terms of the international community, has the UN been a forum where there has been a concrete discussion of nuclear weapons and moving toward some form of disarmament?
There have been many different treaties through the UN that have worked to reduce nuclear weapons and limit the risks of nuclear war. One of the biggest landmark treaties is the Non-Proliferation Treaty, which entered into force in 1970. That's maybe the one that most people would be familiar with. And that actually 191 states around the world have signed on to that treaty. And that really was the first treaty to really move these countries who had nuclear weapons to pursue in good faith, is what they say, pursue in good faith disarmament of nuclear weapons.
That's Article 6 of the treaty.
Many would say today that the U.S. is not pursuing in good faith their disarmament. But, you know, that is something that we are still party to this treaty. And then there have been many others. One that's been talked about a lot today is the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty, or the INF Treaty. Bruce, maybe you have a lot of the particular history on that.
Well, and that really wasn't a U.N. treaty. It was a bilateral treaty between the U.S. and Russia.
Yeah.
But the other major treaty through the U.N. was the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty, which came in the wake of nuclear testing. And then we can perhaps talk a little bit later about what happened most recently, which is the passage of the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons. And that was a major initiative by the U.N., pushed by civil society groups, particularly an organization called ICAN, the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons. And the breakthrough of that more than a year and a half ago was the passage of a treaty, the Treaty to Prohibit Nuclear Weapons, passed by 122 nations, not signed by any of the nuclear nations. But the remarkable thing about that treaty is that it declares it is illegal to test, produce, develop, possess, transfer, or even threaten the use of nuclear weapons to all signatories. The treaty is now being ratified. Once 50 nations around the world actually, through their parliaments and congresses, sign it, it becomes ratified. And so far, 19 nations have ratified it, which is judged to be fairly good progress for a treaty of this complexity. And once that occurs, it will place nuclear weapons in the same category of all the other weapons of mass destruction which have been declared illegal under international law: chemical weapons, biological weapons, and landmines. So it will severely stigmatize nations that continue to own nuclear weapons, possess nuclear weapons, and the pressure is then on them in a way that we haven't seen before. The two-thirds of the world's nations have stated that we need to completely eliminate nuclear weapons, which is a monumental step that has never happened before.
Well, one treaty that's now being discussed, because the Trump regime has announced it's withdrawing from the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty. This alarmed a lot of people, including Mikhail Gorbachev and former Secretary of State George Shultz, in an article in the Washington Post. It was called "Abandoning U.S.-Russia Nuclear Treaty Threatens Our Very Existence."
So this is a treaty that came about in 1987, and it specifically prohibits ground-launched ballistic and cruise missiles within the range of 500 to 5,000 kilometers. And this was a really important treaty, you know, towards the end of the Cold War between the U.S. and, at that time, the Soviet Union, that de-escalated the Cold War at a really crucial time and really set these countries up for a path towards disarmament. And to simply think about throwing that away today is an incredibly dangerous and destabilizing move. These kinds of treaties are what keep us, you know, back from the brink of nuclear war. They are what keep the peace and allow both countries to move towards disarmament and to keep the prospect, as we were saying, of nuclear war off the table. If we were to withdraw, this could potentially start an entirely new nuclear arms race. This is absolutely moving us in the opposite direction that we need to be going in with the U.S. and Russia. And I think what's concerning as well is that it potentially indicates that this administration is thinking of abandoning another crucial treaty, which is the New START treaty, also between the U.S. and Russia, that required both countries to disarm to 1,550 nuclear warheads. If we abandon that, we've now lost all of the major nuclear treaties that control arms in the U.S. and Russia.
The position of the regime in Washington is that Russia is not in compliance with the INF treaty. What's the evidence for that?
Well, there apparently is good evidence that Russia has been developing a new category of short-range missiles, and that's been acknowledged also by members of NATO and the European Union. Russia denies it, but that's not too surprising. The critical thing about this treaty is that these were the most dangerous weapons during the Cold War because these short-range missiles were parked just across the border between the Soviet bloc and the European bloc, with ability to strike major cities on either side in just minutes. And so there was no way of stopping something once it happened. It was so frightening to the Europeans that it led to the most massive civil demonstrations against nuclear weapons in Europe and the U.S. that have ever occurred. Millions of people marched in the streets of European cities because of the terror of these weapons being sighted. It was that led to Gorbachev and Reagan signing, as Lily said, this treaty in 1987 that removed about 900 missiles from the U.S. side, and I think about 1,700 or 1,800 from the USSR, and basically took that flashpoint away. If that is abrogated, if the U.S. walks away from that, and we begin to again place short-range missiles in places like Russia, China is developing short-range missiles, other nations haven't been a part of the treaty, it will be a massive step backward. And so what's being called for is not to walk away from the treaty, but to call Russia out and to sit down and negotiate and try to deal with this through diplomacy. That's the really serious misstep that the Trump administration is taking and has our allies, our European allies, absolutely up in arms for valid reasons. I'd also add that the part of the significance of the INF Treaty is that it led then to the START Treaty with Russia, which was a major treaty to reduce nuclear weapons. So it sort of laid the foundation for a culture of diplomacy between the U.S. and USSR at the height of the Cold War. So the concern is that it begins to shake the very foundations of international diplomacy, which have been what has led to the controls that we've had, the reductions that we've had over the years. So it's clear that Bolton and President Trump are not acknowledging at all the really severe implications of what they're doing, nor what I expect is the president really even aware of that foundation, given that he is so disengaged from this issue.
Adam Smith, who represents Washington State in the Congress, says that, I'm quoting here, "We are stumbling into a dangerous arms race with Russia."
Congressman Adam Smith has been a really strong advocate for more sane nuclear policy, and this is one of the places that he's really stepped out, along with some of his other colleagues. He sent a letter to the Trump administration urging them to reverse this course.
To go back to the NPT, the Non-Proliferation Treaty, three major countries that have weapons of mass destruction, that have nukes, plus the ballistic missiles to deliver them, India, Pakistan, and Israel, more or less U.S. allies, very close U.S. allies, in particularly in terms of India and Israel. Why haven't they been cajoled or coerced into signing the treaty? I mean, they're kind of rogue states.
A couple of things come to mind, David. One is it's been hard to cajole Israel into it because Israel continues to deny it has the weapons. So their formal policy is never to acknowledge themselves as a nuclear nation, which is part of the charade that we're in. India sort of got off scot-free by the U.S. when we provided them nuclear material and didn't require them to sign on to the Nuclear Proliferation Treaty. Pakistan has been sort of a rogue state all along in terms of dealing with their responsibilities as a nuclear nation. So I'm guessing that U.S. pressure or international pressure has not really been applied to the extent that it might have been.
I think also what we see with this and what we're seeing in North Korea as well is that nuclear weapons are still absolutely seen as a status symbol for countries. The treaties that we have thus far and the disarmament that we have undertaken so far in the U.S. has not been enough to make nuclear weapons lose their status as a way to show your power as a country. That's why I think the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons just passed in 2017 is so important, because it works to change that norm. You know, we know that nuclear weapons are inhumane and they have no place in our society, but many countries still don't see them that way, and we need to change that norm so that they are viewed as the despicable weapons that they are, not as a status symbol.
Let's talk about the Iran deal, which was unilaterally abrogated by the president in May of 2018. This was an agreement, not a treaty, in which the five permanent members of the Security Council and Germany engaged in with Iran so that they would not proceed with what was called the development of centrifuges which could possibly be used for weaponizing purposes. Why do you think the Trump administration pulled out of that deal, which seemed to have been working? And according to the IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Agency in Vienna, the UN agency which sent teams to Iran, they were in full compliance with the requirements of the deal. So it seems, from a layperson's perspective, the deal was working.
Right. I mean, who can say why the Trump administration does what they do exactly? I mean, I think we heard about this in Trump's campaigning before he even became president, that this was the worst deal in history. And I think in some ways it has become as much about proving the Obama administration wrong than anything else for this president. And that's a very dangerous way to go into foreign policy. But I think that's certainly a factor.
This was a really important accomplishment. It was an immensely complex treaty. And the diplomacy that went into this on the part of the Obama administration was just exemplary. And pulling these six nations together to do it was an amazing accomplishment. And it has stopped Iran from becoming a nuclear power. And you're right, David, that all indications are from the really credible IAEA that they are compliant with this. In addition, the Trump administration has now heaped on sanctions to further cripple their economy. And I think part of the explanation is that they have tried to hold the treaty accountable for something it was never meant to do. It's been criticized because it didn't deal with other aspects of Iran's behavior that people are upset about, their alleged support of terrorism and so forth. But that was outside the boundaries of what was accomplishable. And so the focus was on nuclear weapons, and it wasn't meant to deal with every other area of agreement between the two nations. So along come people who are not part of this, and particularly Trump, who makes simply a proclamation without any real knowledge of the complexity of what it was meant to do, and calling it the worst ever, which is just part of his ignorance about this complex diplomacy. But other members of his administration, Bolton and others, criticizing it for what it never meant to do, which was dealing with other aspects of Iran's behavior on the international stage. So I think we see that all as just an excuse to pull out of the treaty, to destroy, as Lily said, something that the Obama president has done, which seems to be part of his intent, and to begin to jeopardize one of the most important non-proliferation treaties that we've seen in the last 30 years. It's a catastrophic step on their part, and it's an embarrassment for the world because we have virtually never seen nations pull out of major international treaties like this. There's not even a precedent for it. That's how disruptive it is.
Well, politically speaking, and that's why perhaps the Obama administration crafted it as an accord mm-hmm. rather than a treaty, because right. that occludes mm-hmm. any congressional intervention in the mm-hmm. drafting of a treaty, which requires 2/3 majority vote in the Senate.
And now we mm-hmm. pay the price of that the president can again act unilaterally without having to go back to Congress. So in a sense, we're hoisted on that petard, but it never would have passed Congress, so we can understand why they proceeded the way that they did.
Now, you've mentioned Obama, and you've commented that he talked a good game.
Mm-hmm.
What do you mean by that, he talked a good game?
Right. Well, I think, you know, Obama was very famous for saying in 2009 that we should work towards a world without nuclear weapons. And that's a bold statement for a president to make, and an important one to make, I think. You know, obviously, that was not achieved during his presidency. No one would have expected that. But I think we were disappointed in the amount of progress that went towards that goal. I still think it is important for a president to stand up and say those words and to have that goal. That's, you know, we've moved very far backwards from that point in this administration now with this president. As Bruce said, the Obama administration created the Iran deal, and that is a huge feat of diplomacy. So we can't give Obama no credit. For those of us who work in disarmament, we would have loved to see more. We would have loved to see a no first use policy, or we would have liked to see further steps in disarmament. There were pretty modest reductions in the nuclear arsenal under the Obama administration. And then, of course, the Obama administration signed with Russia the New START Treaty, which required both countries to eliminate a certain number of nuclear weapons, which is a good step forward. But as kind of a compromise in creating that treaty, they also agreed, but that both countries could, quote unquote, modernize their nuclear arsenals. That has really set the U.S. up for a massive spending spree on nuclear weapons, to not really just modernize, but actually to rebuild every single part of our nuclear weapons system. That is set to cost us at least $1.2 trillion over the next 30 years in 2017 dollars. So, you know, the Obama administration had some very great statements and some good progress where it was needed, but also set us up for this rebuild that we're seeing now that, you know, could be, definitely be seen as a new arms race in and of itself.
You're listening to Lily Adams and Bruce Amundson on Preventing Nuclear Apocalypse. This is Independent Alternative Radio.
So if you were to talk to the average, U.S. person, and you're advocating for demilitarization and disarmament, could some of this money possibly better their lives and improve society?
That goes for much of our military budget, which now takes up over 50% of the U.S. federal budget. So the argument about what we could better do to deal with a decaying infrastructure, a massively underfunded civil society, is clear. But I want to go back for a minute to the Obama administration. When Obama declared in Vienna that the world should move towards the elimination of nuclear weapons and committed the U.S. to do that, it was, at the time, a really commendable and bold statement. No American president had ever before declared as policy that it should move towards the elimination of nuclear weapons. And there's very little stomach for that even now in the U.S., even in Congress, even as the U.N. has passed a treaty that commits to move towards that. But Obama ran into, all leaders run into in the U.S. if they try to move too much towards reducing nuclear weapons. Late in his second term, there was significant initiative by Obama and his national security staff to declare for the first time that the U.S. would initiate a no-first-use policy, that absolutely would declare they would never be the first to use nuclear weapons in any conflict. You would think that that would be an easy lift. He wasn't able to accomplish that. We were on a panel with his deputy national security advisor, had that discussion. What happened internally? He was stifled in his ability to do that. And I would say that he ran into what Colonel Lee Butler, previous director of the nuclear weapons program in the 1990s, called the nuclear priesthood. The forces of opposition to us weaning ourselves off nuclear weapons, to reducing high-risk policies, has been, the opposition is immense. And in this case, it turned out that someone we might have thought would be an ally for this, the current Secretary of State at the time, John Kerry, opposed Obama taking this position under some guise of destabilizing relations with other partners like South Korea or Japan. So the nuclear priesthood, which consists of true believers in terms of members of Congress, the defense contractors, the Pentagon, the inertia to deal with significant policy changes on nuclear weapons is massive. That's an example of what we face as we move forward, even when a president was taking what we might think is a rather modest initiative.
Talk about the danger that Dwight D. Eisenhower discussed on his way out of the White House in 1961 in his farewell address. He identified a military-industrial complex. Now, you're here in this state of Washington where there's a massive military presence. There's a bad joke that goes around. If Washington were an independent state, it would be the third most powerful nuclear force in the world. What factor does this military-industrial complex, and I'm talking about Boeing, I'm talking about Lockheed Martin, I'm talking about Raytheon and Northrop Grumman and all of these other huge mega corporations that make enormous amounts of money from war and the war economy?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, first I would say it's not a bad joke. It's absolutely true that if Washington were to be its own country, it would be the third largest nuclear weapons country in the world. For us here in Washington state, that's terrifying. That makes us a target. And we know that working on this issue. But I think you bring up a very good point that our nuclear weapons policy is underlined by these massive corporations who stand to make quite a bit of profit from the continued reliance on nuclear weapons and who spend a lot of money lobbying our members of Congress to keep pushing for policies and, you know, bigger and bigger budgets that include nuclear weapons production. So it's very hard to make progress on disarmament and on better nuclear policy more generally when you have that kind of massive pressure. And all these companies and all of the different nuclear sites are spread out very strategically across the country in many different states so that there are many members of Congress who are directly influenced in getting that direct pressure from different corporations.
Five of the largest military contractors that include Lockheed Martin, Northrop Grumman, Boeing, I saw statistics recently comprise about 40% of the total contracting that is carried out by the federal government for on the military budget. Boeing is somewhat invisible in that regard in Washington because, of course, its production here and its main focus is the domestic airline industry, which is a big employer. But it, last year, obtained the contract to develop the new generation of ICBMs if the whole modernization goes forward. So Boeing is hip deep in the weapons production. It has had a contract for a long time to manage the ICBM, the 400 ICBMs that are stationed out in the Great Plains. And now it's going to be in the ring again for this next generation of ICBMs, which are, I think, widely recognized as the most vulnerable, the most destabilizing, the least defensible of the triad of bombers, missiles, and nuclear submarines. So, let's play this out for a minute, David. Let's say in another couple of years, the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons becomes international law. And these weapons are stigmatized. If countries now use chemical weapons, there's a huge outrage. Look what happened in Syria some months ago when these were used. Once they are outlawed, there's a public outrage that they're used on civilian populations. What will happen to nuclear weapon states? What will happen to companies that are producing nuclear weapons that are now deemed weapons of mass destruction, illegal under international law? We plan to put the spotlight on Boeing. Does our home corporation want to be involved in producing weapons of mass destruction that the majority of nations in the world have said are no longer defensible? We wait for that treaty to be passed, and we plan to then ask Boeing if it wants to continue to be a partner in producing weapons of mass destruction.
In 2018, North Korea and Kim Jong-un were the focus of much attention. There were multiple tests, nuclear tests, the launching of ballistic missiles. Trump has taken great credit for defusing the so-called threat from North Korea. What exactly is going on there in your understanding?
Well, I think that we have to give credit where credit is due. A year, a year and a half ago, when Trump was bombastically threatening to use nuclear weapons, when we have bigger nuclear weapons than you do, this completely irresponsible, ignorant sort of proclamations, it was terrifying for us, terrifying for everybody. It was terrifying for Washington. We're the closest state to North Korea if he had ICBMs that could reach the U.S. So we were very active at that time trying to get our members of Congress to call him out. So the fact that he then backed off and these two leaders engaged in negotiations are engaged in negotiations, I think we all need to acknowledge is a much more positive step than calling each other out. Now, the problem is that the Trump administration's diplomacy is so sophomoric and so primitive and so ill-guided that the likelihood of this resulting in denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula under this regime, I think many of us feel is quite unlikely. But nevertheless, negotiations go on, so that has diffused things considerably, and we don't have at least the kind of saber-rattling going on that was really terrifying all of us a year and a half ago.
I think also we have to give credit to the leadership in South Korea and Moon Jae-in for the huge role that was played there and, you know, what has happened. I think the negotiations that we saw between Trump and Kim Jong-un would not have happened without the leadership in South Korea. I think what we're seeing now is, you know, Trump does like to say that, you know, he has completely diffused this threat and made the world a safer place and is, you know, he, you know, has said that he's in love with Kim Jong-un now. What a statement to make. But what we've seen in reality is that North Korea is continuing their nuclear program. And that seems to be, you know, from sources that we've seen and from evidence that is still going on, they've made some small concessions that are probably even smaller than we would think. There's still so much more work to be done, and it needs to be done in a much more sophisticated way than it was in 2018 when we saw these threats over Twitter being lobbed at each other, these absolutely immature kind of statements about each other. We need to have much more sophisticated diplomacy to actually see results in the denuclearization of North Korea.
And it seems like the door is open enough that some obvious steps could be taken to meet the interests of North Korea. For example, the U.S. agreeing to sign the peace treaty to finally put an end to the Korean War. Wouldn't that seem to be a fairly easy diplomatic effort? Secondly, should we really be continuing to engage in provocative military exercises with South Korea when that's simply raises concerns and suspicions on North Korea? There are common sense things that can be taken that would help in this ongoing effort, particularly, as I said, by South Korea, and its very enlightened leadership right now to try to bring peace to that peninsula.
And what about the role of China and Japan? Would it not be in their national interests to defuse this situation?
Well, wouldn't we think so? There's great debate about China, whether they want a stronger South Korea, given their interests. They're concerned about North Korea and massive migrations across into China. But nevertheless, diplomacy in that area obviously has to involve both Koreas, the U.S., China, and Japan. I think everyone involved in diplomatic relationship recognizes that.
You know, mention was made of the word inertia. And a lot of us experience inertia, but around this particular issue, it's has fossilized into something very solid. So how do you break down that inertia? How do you get people to open their ears and open their eyes to the obvious danger that nuclear weapons present, not to just them, but to humanity and the planet?
It really is one of the most important questions of our time. Since the beginning of the Cold War, we've had really a single set of nuclear policies. They've been Democrats and Republicans alike have supported basically a set of Cold War policies that rely on the concept of deterrence, of massive arsenals, of willing to threaten to use, of maintaining the weapons on hair trigger alert, continuing to fund them, now looking at funding a new generation of weapons across all of the triad. It's been a closed culture. It's this nuclear priesthood that I mentioned before that's almost impossible to penetrate from the outside. Now we see some hope. I'll mention one thing first and then talk about what gives us some reason for hope. With the Democrats taking over the House, Representative Adam Smith of Washington is going to become the chairman of the House Armed Services Committee. And that committee, responsible for overall military policy, setting budgets and so forth, is a very powerful committee. Representative Smith has been very outspoken about challenging existing nuclear weapons policy, about critical of the lack of diplomacy, maintaining that the level of funding for nuclear weapons that is projected for the rebuild of the complex is not sustainable. And he is committed in a way that we have not seen for a chairman of this committee for over 30 years to take up the issue of nuclear weapons in a way that we simply haven't done. For example, the commitment to rebuild this triad at the massive cost that you mentioned earlier was made. There has never been a full public congressional hearing on this issue, even as the commitment was made to move ahead with basically reestablishing a set of weapons that will be in place for the next 30 or 40 years. That's how unexamined it's been publicly. So we are wanting to support what Representative Smith is doing, and we're calling out citizens across the country to contact their members of Congress to say, get behind this. He can't be too far out in front, because we can predict that the industrial complex, the military, is going to come down on him like a ton of bricks once he tries to move this ahead. So this gives a very tangible, specific thing that people across the country can do. We can talk specifically about how they contact members of Congress, but mobilizing other members of Congress now that he's giving some cover for this in a way that we haven't seen before is a very, very important step forward that gives us some chink in the armor of this culture of secrecy and control that has existed around nuclear policies.
You know, we work with a lot of our members of Congress here in Washington State, but I think this is true for members all over the country. They tell us again and again when we meet with them, you know, we want to hear from our constituents more on this issue. They do respond to the things they hear about from constituents, and they're just not hearing about nuclear weapons issues. You know, that hasn't been a big reason for people to call into their offices or email their representatives and senators. So it often feels like you're shouting into the void, but actually contacting your members of Congress on nuclear policy can have a really big effect, because they don't hear about it as much. If just a few emails and calls can really spike their interest, and that can have a really huge impact. So it's a, you know, I think the good news is that there is a way to, you know, for your average person to actually have a really big role in forming better nuclear policy.
Everybody that's listening has a member of Congress, has a representative. Start with a representative. If you know that person, if you've had contact, if you've donated, ask for an appointment. Anybody can ask for an appointment with a member of Congress. And if you get a number of you that are constituents, you very likely will get a meeting and come with a specific request. If that seems intimidating, outlandish, make a phone call or send an email and say, this is what I'd like you to do. If we can get 50, 100 members of the House to begin to step up on this, the House alone can't change these policies, but it can significantly limit funding. It can begin to stop new nuclear weapons additions. So there are now things that can be done, very tangible things that can be done, if this door is being opened by some leadership in Congress that we haven't seen before.
But a lot of people might find it difficult to travel to Washington, D.C. to have an audience with their representative. Could they do that locally?
Absolutely. I think it's often even more effective to meet in district and to bring constituents with you. I think that's one of the most important things is members of Congress want to see that their voters, you know, are the ones who care about this. So going to a meeting with other people, you know, in your area who are all voting for this member of Congress and saying, you know, I care about this issue, that's I think, in some ways much more powerful than a lobbyist in Washington, D.C. or a representative, you know, from an organization in D.C. having that meeting.
You find out when they're not in session, when they're back in the district, and we have to plan ahead. But they come back into the district, and they schedule time with meeting for their constituents. So you just get on the roster and ask for an opportunity.
PSR, Physicians for Social Responsibility. PSR advocates the grassroots tactic of passing local resolutions. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, I think that's very important that you are pairing any work with members of Congress with that pressure from the grassroots, you know, from your average people. You can't have a successful movement without both. We've really taken that to heart. So a big way to make this issue more local for people is to do local resolutions. And we've seen a whole variety of what that can look like, from resolutions that focus on specific nuclear policies, like a no first use policy, as Bruce was talking about, to a movement called Back from the Brink that was really initiated by PSR that takes a look more broadly at all of our nuclear policies and specifically also calls for the elimination of nuclear weapons. But this has been a hugely successful way to engage people more locally because nuclear weapons can feel like a very distant issue. It can feel very complex, and it happens only in the halls of Congress. And this really brings it home, and you can have your city or your county or your state, you know, stand up against these policies that we see as wrong. And that's been very powerful. So we've passed a couple in cities in Washington state. We're working on a state-level resolution for 2019. But we've seen these pass all over the country. And actually, California just was the first state. They actually passed two different resolutions in their state legislature opposing current nuclear weapons policies and calling for better policies in Congress.
It's been a powerful tool. We were meeting with a member of the House of Representatives serving the Olympia District just shortly after the city of Olympia passed a resolution opposing nuclear weapons and calling for their elimination. And so we then took this issue. So your constituents, you know, your city government just passed this. So it connects advocacy with requesting policy change. And our belief is that every kind of advocacy, be it social protests, be it marches, be it letters to the editor, ought to be tied to impacting members of Congress around policy. So that linkage is what is really the emphasis that we've had here, linking advocacy to policy change.
And what role do you see the media playing?
Part of the problem, as we talked about at the very beginning, was that in a lot of ways the public has kind of gone to sleep on the issue of nuclear weapons. I think that's changed to some extent more recently because we did see, you know, the rising tensions with North Korea and the Trump administration, you know, has these many missteps and more dangerous actions. There's not a lot of awareness of this issue for the average person. And actually for myself, for my generation, I'm 25, you know, when I talk to my friends about this issue, this is not an issue that they are concerned about. It's not on their top 10, you know, list of things that they're thinking about. So we definitely need more media coverage of this very important issue. And media coverage that is not just covering the kind of wonky politics, but also just educational and telling people about the issues like we were just talking about that are affecting them and their communities as they relate to nuclear weapons. your average person has a role to play in the media coverage around this issue because anyone can submit a letter to the editor or an op-ed. This can be really powerful, especially in local papers, to start a dialogue in your own community about nuclear weapons issues. You can be the one to get it started by submitting a letter to the editor. And that's a really powerful tool that I think people sometimes forget about.
The Bulletin of Atomic Scientists in 1947 set up something called the Doomsday Clock. And in 2018, the clock was at 2 minutes to midnight. Why do you think the danger is so sharp right now?
The Doomsday Clock is a relative judgment about the risks to the human community from particularly nuclear war, but also factoring in implications now of a warming planet, creating more international instability, migrations, creating more tensions for war. And what it is reflecting is that we are at greater risk of nuclear war than we were during much of the Cold War. That's a very sobering assessment. There is no negotiations, no diplomacy going on around nuclear weapons. We have new armed states coming on, like North Korea. We have bombastic leaders in high-risk situations like Pakistan and India. So we have a combination of circumstances that lead to a greater threat of either the accidental or the intentional use of nuclear weapons than we've seen. And that moved the doomsday clock from 3 minutes to 2 minutes. And I would say that there are two issues that really pose the greatest risks from the standpoint of nuclear policies on the U.S. side. The first is that we have never declared that we will not use nuclear weapons first. Secondly, nuclear weapons in both the U.S. and Russia continue to be on hair trigger alert, on what we call launch on command, which means if there is an imminent threat, these weapons can be launched with no further review. This is the great risk because that means that they can be launched if there's an accident. And there have been multiple examples when we came perilously close to nuclear war from erroneous radar or electronic mishaps in the command system. So these weapons should be taken off, launch on command, so that there is time to review what's happening in case there's a decision to launch nuclear weapons. And that's particularly the case for the ICBMs, which are the most risky weapons we have. So keep those two requests in mind and contact members of Congress and deal with the most substantial risks.
Yeah, I would absolutely agree with that assessment. It's important for people thinking about this issue today to remember that there is hope. I think we're coming into 2019 with hope about the prospects for creating better nuclear policy and optimism, even if it's cautious optimism. Congressman Adam Smith, now the chairman of the House Armed Services Committee, and the House, and now, you know, flipping to be controlled by the Democrats. We've also seen some really prominent people in Congress speak up about this issue. Elizabeth Warren recently gave a foreign policy speech in which she outlined really bold stances on nuclear weapons and the need for reductions in nuclear weapons. So having these really key players come out against these is really important. But I think what we were talking about before, too, of the really important role of your average person, your average activist in this issue is another reason for optimism. From our work in Washington State, where we have paired this really specific advocacy with members of Congress, with the building of a grassroots movement, we have been so excited to see that work. And we're seeing the changes in policy already with our members of Congress from people who had said, you know, this was not an issue that they felt that they needed to work on. This was not something they cared about. To now standing up and taking bold stances on nuclear policy. We've shown that citizen activism and advocacy on this issue can really make a big difference. And so that is something to not forget. You know, this can be a very distressing issue to think about and learn about, but we're seeing progress happening right now from the work we're doing. And so there's good reason to feel confident that your advocacy can make a difference.
In a relatively short period of time. In 1 to 2 years, we've seen most members of our delegation step up on the issue in ways that they have not before.
I'm reminded of what the great abolitionist and revolutionary Frederick Douglass once said, that if there is no struggle, there is no progress. Power concedes nothing without a demand.
That's absolutely the truth.
Well, I want to thank you, Bruce Admonson, and Lily Adams for joining us on Alternative Radio.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You were just listening to Lily Adams and Bruce Amundsen on Preventing Nuclear Apocalypse. I talked with them in Seattle. Lily Adams and Bruce Amundsen are both active with WPSR, Washington Physicians for Social Responsibility. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, based in Boulder, Colorado. We are independent and part of the nonprofit organization Rise Up. We are supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature progressive voices rarely heard in the media, such as Stephen Bezruchka, Arjun Singh Sethi, Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, Francis Fox Bivin, and Chris Hedges. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. This program was recorded at the Jack Straw Cultural Center in Seattle. Special thanks to Jim Sawyer. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening.